wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could.
Oh man, that sounds great. Is that Paula Cole? Oh man, Paula Cole is going to be playing at the Egg on the 21st, which is 2 days from now. So that's what, Saturday night? That's Saturday night. And new album is Ballads, and she sounds great. Theegg.org for more information on that. Well, good morning. Welcome. We'll be playing some more of her music throughout the panel. And let me welcome you to our group this morning. It's the 19th of October, 13 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. Do you know where your panelists are? I do. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
You're looking fetching, and you're, it looks almost like a...
We went to North Carolina. Here's the story. We went to North Carolina when Mary Grant was being inaugurated.
She's not quite a peacoat, but kind of, yeah.
And we went into a store, Roselle and I, and we found this, the fierce Roselle. She knows why we call her lovely Roselle now. She wants to be called the fierce Roselle.
Okay.
And we went into a store, and we found this. And then it disappeared. And yesterday, she marched me into our clothing closet, my side of the closet, and we took down all the suits and everything else and all the pants, which I'll never wear again, and all the stuff, some stuff for the Goodwill and the rest of it, and there it was.
Uh-huh.
So in respect to that, in respect to the fierce Roselle, I'm wearing it today.
And the autumnal, the autumnalness in the weather. Well, you look fetching, sir. It's good to have
thank
you.
Thank you so much.
It's good good to have you here. Vera Acarias-Kelly joins us as well. She is a political science professor at Siena College, and it's a thrill to have you here. Thank you very much.
And
for
talk about
me.
Fierce. She's as tough as nails.
Oh, good. Glad to know.
Comparative politics is Vera's specialty, and we'll be getting into we'll be doing a lot of comparing, I believe, over the next 90 minutes or so. Joe Bonilla is with us. We missed him last week. He's here this week, and we're thrilled. And he is a communications consultant and one of our favorites, and we thank you very much for being here.
Great to be here. Good morning.
Hey, Joe, you got to show up every week.
Every week.
Once you're captured, you're captured.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Release me, please.
Actually, his lack of showing up last week, it was my screw-up, actually.
So terrible.
He did the right thing. I did the wrong thing. Anyway, it's a thrill to have you all here. Thank you very much. So let's talk about what's going on in the news, and we'll talk about the condolences call story, because we haven't really spent any time on it. I thought it would just be one of those things that was, you know, sort of a distraction, and it was a little bit of a, I don't know, that it would sort of go away. It would be a flash, and maybe it was a story that we're spending too much time on. Well, it's now become a big, big deal as far as what we've been talking about, and I guess even given the hypocrisy of, on one hand, you're talking about every football player has to stand for the national anthem, and you're disrespectful for your country if you don't. And then you see how he has been talking to the mothers and fathers of these fallen soldiers, and you think to yourself, well, that doesn't make any sense. So President Trump's condolence call to the widow of a slain soldier exploded into a vicious row that swamped the White House on Wednesday, with the soldier's grieving mother accusing the president of disrespecting her family, and a defiant Mr. Trump complaining that his words had been cynically twisted for political purposes. The back and forth made a furious spectacle of what is, at the best of times, one of the most emotionally wrenching contacts between the commander-in-chief and a bereaved citizen. It overshadowed any talk of Mr. Trump's legislative priorities and instead recalled his history of feuding with military families, or even, and in the case of Senator John McCain, a war hero. 12 days after four Americans were killed in an October 4th ambush in Niger, the president called the widow of Sergeant David T. Johnson, who was among the slain, and said that her husband knew what he signed up for, referring to the soldier only as your guy, according to Sergeant Johnson's mother and a Democratic congressman who both listened to the call. Mr. Trump angrily disputed that account, insisting that he only had very nice conversation with the woman, with the wife, who sounded like a lovely woman. The White House accused the congressman Frederica Wilson of Florida of politicizing a sacred ritual after Mr. Trump initially said she fabricated it. So But by the way, who was politicizing what? Because it was the president who was in the during the press conference with who was he with? Oh, he's with Mitch McConnell. Was with Mitch McConnell on Monday, and that's when the whole thing came up. And when he started to talk about how he, unlike other presidents, actually made the phone calls, saying that he was the guy, a better consoler in chief than his predecessors, which then brought General Kelly into it because apparently General Kelly, who lost his son in Afghanistan, said that he had never received a call, although that doesn't turn out to be entirely accurate, as the First Lady invited the family at that time to the White House, and there was some condolences there. So it's a big mess. And now I throw it over to the panel to try to make sense of what is happening here. Alan, we'll start with you.
Okay. Well, 24-hour news cycle is the death knell for this particular president, because something has to lead, and this is now it. This has become the one thing that a news director at CNN or at MSNBC, they put their finger up into the air and they want to see which way, and they wet their finger and they want to see which way the wind is blowing and what will be most interesting to the American people. Now, on the one hand, we see the possibility of nuclear war with North Korea. And on the other hand, we see this. It doesn't seem like it all adds up, except that that news director knows what's going to play in the minds of the American people. And that's why it gets done that way, which is too bad for Donald Trump. Although we have the theory of the bright shining light, which may take away from the other stuff that he's trying to pull. On the substance of it, he does look ridiculous. But in fact, one thinks that when you're taking away the child health program from millions of American children who will not have proper health care, I think he'd rather have this than that.
Well, it's certainly just, another, milestone in terms of how can we reduce the level of the presidency. And you look at this whole exchange where the commander-in-chief calls the parents of fallen soldiers and totally politicizes, totally makes it a tabloid, tabloidic fodder. And it's incredibly sad because this should not be something where it's discussed. And to also then have the regard to bring in his chief of staff, General Kelly, and to bring that whole emotion back for General Kelly and his wife about their son. It's totally disrespectful in that way.
Every time you come, I learn something. And I never knew, but I'm going to use it all the time, the word tabloidic.
A talmudic.
So one other thought I had, I also wanted to broaden it a little bit since you mentioned I was a comparativist. So here is what I'm thinking about when I see President Trump doing such a poor job at attempting to console families. Perhaps the questions we should also ask and raise is, why did it take the White House 12 days to respond to what was happening in Niger?
And by the way, what the hell happened there?
What the hell happened there? That is exactly the question, because we don't know anything except for we have special forces in Niger, which is clearly, south of
No, I said
Algier.
Niger. Is that not true? Is that
well,
not
it's
right?
Either,
I've heard it pronounced a whole bunch of different ways.
So
Niger
it's,
is one.
Niger is Niger, the... Yeah.
Well, which way do you want me to say it?
It is up to you. I'm using the sort of more French African pronunciation.
Okay.
Niger.
And while we're at it, what is it? Is it Qatar?
Qatar.
So,
Qatar.
Coming back to the question of
Niger,
what is happening in the country? We know there is an Al Qaeda unit that is very active in the region. We have Africa Command. We don't know exactly what's going on with Africa Command. Why was it that the four soldiers, special forces, were killed? How did it come about? Local forces were also injured and killed along the way. A group of Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb and Sahel attacked the U.S. special forces. What is the status of this particular organization? Is it growing now that Raqqa has fallen in Syria? What is the future of the U.S.'s commitment to in terms of its involvement in Syria? What is happening with the Kurdish community, which is in an uprising right now, absolutely distraught over a lack of U.S. support. Now that the al-Baadi government, which is, you know, used Shiite forces to send them into Kurdish regions, is taking back territory there. What does our counterterrorism policy look like, and why is it that Iran just gained a foothold in some of the formerly Kurdish-dominated areas? Our foreign policy is a mess. We don't know. We don't have clarity. We need to look at what happened in Niger and start communicating with the American people about what commitment we are making to various parts in the world and why.
And instead, we're talking about a phone call and obviously the deflection of the responsibility of the commander-in-chief.
But right. And I started off by saying that we sort of resisted the story for a little while. But that is one of the reasons that I wanted to talk about it today, because underlying it are some really major issues, right, that we should be looking at. I don't quite understand. There's also the story, the other attached story, just because we get into this whole thing about what he said and when he said it and so forth. And then there was the other strange story that he apparently called another family of a fallen soldier, offered them money, which he never paid.
$25,000,
which he never paid. Then when that was pointed out by the Washington Post, well, then he finally wrote the check.
Right.
So, doesn't this get to, and Vera and I were talking about this before we went on the air, which it just seems to be sort of, I believe you called it, and I apologize for putting words into your mouth, but something to the effect of linguistic ineptitude.
We were talking about the issue of the role that the commander-in-chief or consoler-in-chief should be playing, and instead, what he does, he seems to be not finding the accurate terminology, the empathy, the ability to actually just listen or ask basic questions. Tell me about your husband. Perhaps you might want to know the fallen soldier's first name when you speak to the widow or the father. And the
instead
idea,
of your guy.
Your guy was perhaps, if that was what he said, that's quite disturbing. Your guy. How about, you know, using the person's first name and showing some empathy, some understanding of what's happening. And then also this question about paying money. I mean, where does this come
it's
from?
Not a reality show. It's not a reality show.
What is this? It's just like, I mean, in the moment he felt like, well, I got to help that guy because, you know, the parents are divorced and the mother was the designated recipient of life insurance, military life insurance, or whatever that payment was. And so President Trump decides to give the father, who he feels bad for, $25,000. I mean, yeah, it's just a strange choice.
And then, so there's the giving of the money, but then you don't send the check. Promise the guy the $25,000, and then you don't send the check, even though it's bizarre that he offered the money in the first place.
Right. Which of course, goes to the whole Trump record of bankruptcy.
Of not paying anybody.
Because when bankruptcy comes up, somebody's left with their hand out who gave you a service and you can't, and is now refusing to pay for.
Right, and you look at that Washington Post list that David Fahrenthold had put together that had every one of these charities that he didn't pay, that he made promises of millions of dollars. So this is just another one on that list, and those pages keep on growing.
Now, the idea that you have a commander, and maybe I'm being petty on this, but you mentioned that not even knowing the name, but doesn't that also show just sort of a looseness within the White House where there would be a person who would... you know, we watch Veep and we watch House of Cards, where, you know, there's always that person who's behind the president who gives him the card that says, "Oh, this is Mrs. Mm-hmm. Cunningham." You know, and that you have, and this is the person that you're going to talk to, and they have this. You know, they have handlers. So this is the person. So why isn't that happening? Why is that basic fundamental logistic sense within any organization, but especially the White House, not employed here.
Well, come on, Joe. You know full well that that the answer to your question is he doesn't listen to them.
No,
that's right.
So the note can be there hanging in the wind.
Yeah.
He just won't read it.
Let's give the benefit of the doubt to the staffers, because I'm sure they gave him a file.
Oh, I'm sure they did, but I just...
Or they were afraid to give him a file.
Right.
Oh, no, they gave him a file, I'm sure. And, you know, the other question about General Kelly's son, I'm sure there was a conversation in detail about something that General Kelly said, and then Trump just picks up sort of a snippet of that information, takes it out of context, and then makes some statement about how he's the only one who's calling everybody.
Right. It's
I'm
like
sure
an internal.
That's not what General Kelly said.
Right. It's like an internal game of telephone, almost, right?
Nor is it good for General Kelly. I mean, I think this guy's entitled to privacy over that issue, and he throws the red meat right out there.
And then Sarah Huckabee Sanders yesterday during the White House briefing, which I watched from beginning to end yesterday, and I have no idea why, but I did.
Me
and
neither.
It's painful. It is painful. But she said that, you know, that General Kelly is appalled by the politicalization of this. And okay, but who made it political? I mean, none of this would have come out if the president hadn't mentioned in the first place about General Kelly's son.
Hey, Joe, up is up, up is down, in is in, in is out. That's this president's MO. That's what he does. Nothing, I've said it again and again on the show, nothing means anything. We see him support, a health care agreement in the United States Senate, and then 2 days later, unsupport his health care, the same health care agreement. The last guy in the room is who he's listening to.
And he's not the kind of person who collects a lot of information and puts together a complex puzzle. So he just takes certain ideas that are convenient that day, publicizes them, and then he moves on.
Okay, but he is, let's all remember this, he is the president of the United States, and he got there somehow. And he got there using this particular playbook that he is using every day in front of the American people to get where he went.
Right, but there's one way of using that playbook for a campaign versus governing.
I don't know. I mean, he's clearly convinced that that's not the case.
Yeah, well, Joe. I guess the reality is that it's showing it is the case that it's not working so much.
No, I don't know about that.
I mean, from what we hear, though, that he often finds himself in these these are the stories that you hear from unnamed White House staffers and reports and press reports, which are he is surprised that people respond the way they do to what he says. Like that even while there is some throwing some meat, and we certainly see that, there are also times where he just doesn't understand why something becomes a story because he botched it
in some way. No, he says that. He says that. I don't know that it is the case that he really feels that way.
All right. So we're just about, we have to go to a break. So we're going to pause for a moment. We're going to remind listeners that they can send us letters. They can send us your letters at WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. Alan Chartok is here. Vera Acarius Kelly is with us from Siena College. Joe Bonilla, communications consultant. And again, we welcome your letters, panel@WAMC.org.
And then she said, I got some news this morning from Choctaw Ridge. Today, Billy Joe McAllister's jumped off the...
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. It is the 19th of October, and we are very happy to have you with us this morning. Joe Bonilla, Vera Acarius Kelly, Alan Chartok with a fistful of letters and ready to read them. We welcome your letters, panel@WAMC.org. Alan?
Okay, Jeffrey writes, good morning, panel. Could you please find some time to discuss the upcoming vote on the Constitutional Convention? Many people I speak with know practically nothing about it, and thanks from Jeff. Jeff, what I want you and everybody else who's listening right now who's interested in the Constitutional Convention and whether to have one, to go to the Capital Connection program. We've had a couple of them on this, including last week's with Professor Gerald Benjamin.
That's excellent.
Who is one of the big pushers of this. So again, the Capital Connection, or go to WMC.org and write in Gerald Benjamin, Gerald with a G. So you'll find out the entire scope of the issue there. Thank you. And And we heard from Dorothy, who said, Trump pointedly deflected the reporter's question asking what happened in Niger. What is being hidden here? This is his and the Congress Benghazi. His diversion is his habit when he doesn't want to give a straight answer. It has happened before. Thank you for the show. Keep up the great work. And that's from Dorothy. Anybody just...
Well, I mean, I obviously agree with Dorothy because when we hear, you'll find out. That's whenever he wants to deflect.
And
or
most of the
redirects.
Time, we don't find out.
We don't we get some kind of partial information or, you know, in this case, I think it's really important for journalists to keep asking, what happened in Niger? Why did it happen? What is our foreign policy, our counterterrorism policy? What is the role of Africa Command?
And, you know, think for a second, if this had been Hillary's presidency... And the Republicans were in control of the Congress, what they would be saying about this.
Yeah, it'd be Benghazi, too. They would have said that immediately. It would have been branded that way.
Yeah. Okay, and Michael says, didn't he say he had proof of his version of the phone call to the bereaved wife? Well, let's see it. I'm sure there is proof, by the way. I'm sure that there's proof of his conversation. Whether there's proof of his interpretation is a whole different thing, right?
Yeah. Well, we've said this many times in the past, but when you say if you had it, you would probably present it so you could end the whole thing, right?
Right, but I think even later in the day, the White House had backed off on whether or not they had a recording of the call or not.
Oh, it's hard to believe that the President of the United States... Okay, so Russell says he doesn't have empathy, so why are we asking for it? You don't go to a gas station to buy a house. The man doesn't have it. And, quote, in big capital letters with three exclamation points, he doesn't care.
All right.
Well, we need you on the show, apparently.
That's a good point. You don't go to a gas station to buy a house.
Well, I know somebody who did.
All right, so we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. All right, let's move on to some other topics, and let's go to our friend Jeff Sessions, who had testimony yesterday discussing his conversations with Trump about James Comey, who was fired as the head of the FBI. And Russia. One after another, Democrats in the Senate Judiciary Committee pressed Attorney General Jeff Sessions to provide information, and again in nearly 5 hours of testimony, Mr. Sessions refused. The lawmakers asked for more details about his conversations with President Trump before he fired James Comey, the former FBI director, and pardoned Joe Arpaio, the former sheriff in Arizona. They wanted to know that the two had discussed about what the two had discussed about Robert Mueller, the special counsel investigating Russia's interference in the 2016 election and possible links to Mr. Trump. The senators also asked about topics not involving the president, like whether Mr. Sessions had conversations with the attorney general of Texas about an immigration program the state had threatened to sue over, and whether any evidence supported Mr. Trump's claim that the Cuban government was behind sonic attacks on American diplomats. I'm just not able to comment, Mr. Sessions said, and apparently demurred over and over again.
And Joe, that's from the New York Times you're reading?
That is from the New York Times.
Okay. You know, it's certainly because the Attorney General also said he could not assert executive privilege, nor could he disclose the confidential conversation he had with the president. But, you know, it will be interesting to see how the president reacts to this bit. I mean, we saw how the president reacted when the Attorney General recused himself, obviously, in the Russia investigation, and there was that story of being yelled at and lambasted in the Oval Office. So it'll be interesting to see what the president's reaction will be for this.
So what do we make out of this in the sense of what we get out of really little to no information from the attorney general?
Well, the first thing we get out of it, I believe, is that we have now learned that Jeff Sessions knows what he can't do anymore. He can't go up there before the Congress of the United States and start telling the truth, because that's when he got himself into trouble. He lied. You know, he said, I had nothing to do with the Russians. Then it turned out he did have something to do with the Russians. If he invokes executive privilege or something like it every moment and says, I'm sorry, I can't discuss that with you, you know, it's a big nothing. So now we have, if you were watching it yesterday, and it was very interesting, you have some of Patrick Leahy, who is a senior, somber decent fellow who doesn't go out reaching for headlines, basically saying, no. You know, I want you to tell me the truth, and growling at him. It doesn't matter. So what? The Times says he growled at him, which they did say. But so what? It's not a story. All he did was to say no, 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 and no.
Right. Yeah.
He learned something.
Right. The entire story is just their questions, but really he gave the same answer every single time.
Right.
So where do we go from here on this then? With that said, where do we go from here?
Well, we know the Russia investigation is ongoing. We have it speeding up. In my understanding, there are more and more interviews that Robert Mueller is pursuing. And so whatever Sessions does or doesn't do, in the end, does not matter that much because Robert Mueller is closing in, I believe.
It is interesting, right, Vera, that he was asked. I mean, the one thing that came closest to landing, I think, was okay, so have you spoken to Mueller about this? And there's utter silence. Mm. And he said, I asked you, have you spoken to Mueller about this? And with great pain, he said, no. And there, what was the name of the guy on the television? He used to hold up a sign, and he would say, "He's lying." I don't remember what Joey Souza or something like that. And he said, "He's lying," and he took a long time to answer, and then he said, "No." They asked him a second time. He was asked a second time by Leahy, and he said, "No," a second time. Now that's interesting. Why don't you ask if you're Mueller? And you have the Attorney General of the United States, who is theoretically your boss, right? I mean, after all, he delegated. Why do you take so long to say no in that way? And what specter does that bring up in your mind? What if he? Let's assume he's telling the truth. Why wasn't he asked by Mueller, you know, to talk about what he knew? It may be, at least in my mind, that he becomes a subject of this investigation. And so it would make sense that if you want him to testify, you got to give him immunity. And they weren't giving him immunity. That's for sure.
We also, and I don't know, help me out, political scientists, that it seemed at the beginning of this administration, everybody talked about the great respect that members of the Senate had for Jeff Sessions, and he was their guy and one of their own, and that seems to be eroding, though, right? I mean, that seems to be not that the reverence that they had at the beginning all those months ago.
Yeah, I mean, that generally
seems to be eroding.
Right. I mean, that generally erodes for most cabinet secretaries if they were appointed from the House or Senate. They think that, oh, I was just one of you. I was one of you at one point. But that generally...
Well, yeah, you know, it is interesting that you bring that up, Joe, because I was thinking about that also. Of course I was. After Joe makes a good point, I always say, I was thinking about that too. but you're right, because the people on the other side, on the Democratic side, were showing a unified front yesterday, and they were saying, don't give us this garbage. We want to know. We want answers to our questions. And it did strain Sessions' credibility with his executive sense of things. In other words, this was bringing it to the, as I think the Times put it, to the breaking point of saying, no, I'm not going to tell you. Now, what kind of respect for the institution do you have when you keep saying, I'm not going to tell you?
Right.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We will have more letters. We welcome yours. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We will also move on to other topics as well. Alan Chartok, Vera Carias-Kelly, and Joe Bonilla with us this morning. We welcome your letters, and we'll be back right after this. Paula Cole doing our bumper music. She's going to be at The Egg on Saturday night, and you can find out more information by going to theegg.org. Of course, the theme song to one of my favorite shows in college, Dawson's Creek.
Great to know.
Yeah, that is essential information.
I think so.
And I think if it's important to you, Joe, it's important to all.
Yes, that's...
thank you very much. I'm testing it out to be our new theme. Well, good morning. Welcome back. And let's go to other topics as we await new letters. And we welcome yours. Paddle.
Poundstone.
Thank you. Paddle@wamc.org. All right. So what else is happening in the world? And there's a lot. I think when we look at we've been talking obviously about the well, Jeff Sessions and the military families, but the other big issue, of course, that's been happening or not happening, depending on how you look at it, is healthcare. And what has basically this again has been the trying to figure out what Trump says versus what he means and the administration. So there was a bipartisan healthcare push that came out thanks to Senators Lamar Alexander, the Republican from Tennessee, the plaid-clad senator from Tennessee, and Patty Murray, the Democrat from Washington. So they come out with a plan. And then initially the White House came out and said it may be a good short-term plan. It may work for a little while. And then President Trump became the subject of an unusual public lobbying campaign over the fate of the Affordable Care Act. As Senate Democrats and a key Republican sought to salvage bipartisan health care while conservatives pressured the president to disavow the agreement. And then while tweeting, the president appeared to distance himself from the compromise and then later said it sounded like it was something that would be good. And then the convoluted campaign got even more convoluted when Chuck Schumer comes in and insisted that a deal remained in reach, even as he blasted the president's zigging and zagging, which seems to be a fairly good description of what the president was doing.
So let's go back to square one for a moment.
Yes, sir.
And say, what are the implications of taking children's health care away from them or taking, you know, what has been loosely called Obamacare, you know, away from the American people and maybe kicking 20 to 23 million people, you know, off of this? So I always come back to the basic question, will people die as a result of not having proper health care? The answer, of course, is yes. I mean, if you've got severe diabetes and some or a white blood cell count that is through the roof, and you go for preventative care, they take a blood test and they find it, they can save your life. And if you don't go, they cannot. And so therefore, we make a big thing about individuals who murder other individuals. I know people might take object to this rhetoric. But, you know, in some ways, this is much worse than an individual walking into a candy store.
Well, the whole question about the CHIP program that you mentioned earlier, yes. Alan, you know, there are 9 million children that are off this plan now. 11 states are just using emergency funds that they have until December to
and
pay
fact,
for the
and
healthcare.
In fact, if I can just interrupt for 1 second and tell you that Andrew Cuomo is under great pressure to call a special session of the legislature to handle some of this stuff.
Right.
I mean, it's outrageous. These are children, the future of this country. If we don't have the moral commitment to providing health care to our children, where is this country at? So, I'm just appalled.
So the question is, when you say these are our children, these are not Donald Trump's children. These are not these are people who have limited resources. Often, but not always, they're black. Often, they're poor. And so therefore, this is a piece that fits into what many of us see as a war against black people, for example. Really, and against poor people, because a lot of these guys, they just don't give a damn.
Right. I mean, this is a whole policy of basically looking at, you know, people of color, people of lower to middle income means, and really it's a policy of what can we do to subvert their success versus looking at opportunities to build it up.
And, you know, these are children from families the families earn twice the minimum income for a family of four. So we're talking about an annual income of $49,200, right? So
well, I think it even goes higher than that in some cases, because in other words, I know people who make significantly more than that who are still on the
Yeah, if they have special circumstances, right. For example.
They pay more, by the way. They pay
more. Yes, and they pay more. But the idea is that, you know, these are families that really need our assistance for their children to live healthy lives. And we want our children to live healthy lives because then they can attend, they can finish high school, attend college, get job training, and be contributing citizens in the future of this country.
Or they can be in prison because they had no resources growing up, educationally, health-wise, or otherwise. We have decisions to make here.
I mean, these are children. Children are not at fault for anything that happens in their lives. They must be supported within a democratic nation. It is just something. I mean, I believe there are many Republicans that are also thinking along those lines. There's a high level of support, in essence, for the CHIP program, and I think we will see pushback against this wiggling or zigzagging.
Well, we look at the CHIP program, and we look at obviously in preceding months about the Dreamers program. So again, this focus on issues that affect children that can't speak for themselves.
That's right.
But obviously want to do the right thing.
Yes, I agree.
Well, yes, and in response to that, I would say you take. There's an old joke. How do you know the president is lying? And the answer is when his lips are moving. So he's been talking about being concerned about gay people or about black people or about people of color. And in fact, it's nonsense. It's just nonsense. If you take a look at the bigger picture, this is a guy who is really trying to destroy a particular class in order to gain the approbation of the people who are the haters in this country. I think that's the case. I don't think you can move away from it.
Or he's simply lacking any understanding what's happening in families' lives in this country. He is focused on what he perceives within his wheelhouse, making deals, tax cuts, some kind of he wants to have a stimulus for the economy that is a top-down plan. I mean, all of these ideas show me that, well, we know he lacks the ability to be sensitive and express empathy, but here we can also see a complete misreading of what is happening in American families.
Not surprisingly, and with great respect, I don't agree with you.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I truly believe he's much smarter than you give him credit for. I think he knows how he got elected to the presidency. I think he knows the group of people who he has to satisfy in order to survive politically. Right now, since you and I were talking in the break about the 35 to 40% of the people who have not moved off the dime no matter what he does, which means if he got elected president of the United States once, he could do it a second time. And there will be people on the other end of the radio right now holding their hands on their ears and saying, no, don't say that. It's impossible. Mm-hmm. It's not impossible.
Well, I think what he has is an instinct for sort of political gamesmanship. I don't know that he really... I wouldn't call him analytical. I wouldn't call him insightful. He has sort of this gut instinct of what works and how he can puppeteer certain types of people.
Wouldn't say political gamesmanship. I would say more media gamesmanship. Uh-huh, because, again, if it was political gamesmanship, we would have seen more successes out of this administration.
And let me just say, he's president of the United States one more time. And he thinks he can, by sticking to that formula, and I don't know that he's wrong, he can be president of the United States another time.
At the risk of sounding like I'm arguing with you, which I'm not.
God help you.
But there's a difference between being the president of the United States and being good at being the president of the United States.
Well, absolutely, there is. But he is the president of the United States.
We got
States.
That. But he's not doing a good job.
No, he's not.
Well, we all agree with that. But he arrived at his present perch with a formula, Joe.
But we can say that the pilot was really good when we hired him. But then, if he keeps drinking in the cockpit, then maybe he isn't the best pilot anymore.
We can say that.
Yeah. But that would mean the pilot was good to begin with.
It doesn't mean you can say that, but he was a really great pilot.
You know, his co-pilot's
I've been arguing with all of you for years, and Vera, of course, knows that the difference between being as a political scientist is I have to look at what is as opposed to what should be. Now, what is that he's the president of the United States. What is that the 40% that have been following him all along, he hasn't lost any of that, 35 to 40%.
Well, we were talking about this last week. There's still 33, 34% of the people that believe that the moon landing was fake. I mean, there's still the 33% of the people who believe that the Holocaust never existed. So, I mean, I don't know.
Going back to my political science roots. And as I get older, I forget more and more of them. But one of the things that I do understand about this country is everything you just said is true. But
we have a break. That's
okay,
all.
Break.
Okay, we'll take a break. We'll continue our discussion and. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. I'm just looking at Ray. His head's ready to fall off. So, ready to go. Okay.
We can't have that.
We'll be right back after this.
You knew just what I was there for. You heard me say.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. That's a beautiful voice. Blue Moon.
Yes,
oh, God. Gorgeous stuff. Paula Cole singing from her new album, Ballads, and we'll be performing Saturday night at The Egg, and you can find out more by going to theegg.org. And, you can have a nice weekend.
I hope she sings Blue Moon, because, you know, the Satellites for Music Out of This World. That was my band.
That was your band. I was just going to say,
band. Yeah. We played that all the time.
Yeah, Blue Moon.
It was a great song.
Did anyone sing on the Satellites?
Yes, the drummer, Mike Lamoro, he sang.
Where is he now?
He's been a musician all of his life, and I think he's just about retiring now, although he does play the drums still, and he's terrific. Mm. Mike Lamoro, I love that guy.
With that, we'll move on. We have a lot of letters, so you have a fistful of letters.
I do. Will Trump take credit for... from John. His Dow Jones average skyrocketing as a result of Janet Yellen and the Fed borrowing from itself at 0% real negative rates and continuing to expand its balance sheet by buying boatloads of stock that have to eventually be liquidated. U.S. debt now exceeds $22 trillion with no end in sight. I guess no one cares as long as it means to pay it is still in the woods. Well, I murdered that letter.
Yeah. We got the gist, though, right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Anthony says, the ultimate capitalist. Trump is the ultimate capitalist, parenthesis, pig. His ideology... I'm just reading what it says.
Wow, all right.
His ideology...
Not holding back today, are they?
His ideology parallels the ideal of survival of the fittest. If you can afford it... I'm so sorry. If you can't afford it, you can't get it. The best we hope for is that Trump gets visited by three ghosts this holiday season. Hmm. And that's from Anthony. Yeah. And Catherine says, the conservative, parenthesis, code, Ayn Rand, view of supporting stressed populations is that they've made their own failure and don't deserve any help. This not only denies the institutional basis for inequality, but also cannot conceive of the value of investing in our citizens.
We'll ask about Ayn Rand tomorrow when Aaron's on.
Good point. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Did you want to say something
about
Ayn Rand?
I was just thinking. I mean, we do have to invest in the future of this country, which means our human resources, our children, in terms of education and health. There is no question about that. Whatever it costs, that is our future. All children. Of course, all children.
I think that's a point which Trump sometimes misses.
Yeah.
Okay. Jude, who writes fairly regularly, Trump versus Pence. At least Trump has grotesque entertainment value. The Terry Gross interview yesterday on WAMC with the New Yorker writer of Understanding Mike Pence is scarier than ever. Pence, as the voice of the Koch brothers, 100% opposed to Planned Parenthood and a man for whom women are apparently nothing more than temptresses. You know, the fierce Roselle, formerly the lovely mm-hmm. Rochelle, and I were having that discussion just last night about this New Yorker article,
right.
And it is interesting that I kept thinking about Spiro Agnew. That's part of being old that is good, because you remember some of this stuff. Spiro who? Many people are saying, well, mm-hmm. he was the vice president of the United States, and before they could get rid of Tricky Nixon, they had to get rid of Agnew, which they did. And he went, mm-hmm. and that, of course, is how we got Gerald Ford.
Yes.
As the president of the United States. So one wonders whether jumping out of the frying pan into the fire would be a good thing if this guy who is so anti-gay, for example.
Yeah, so the only thing I can say to that, domestically, of course, it would be very difficult and challenging and scary. But internationally, it would be perhaps a little more stabilizing to have Pence. And I'm not a big fan of Pence.
Well, it's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I would not disagree with that. Mm-hmm. But certainly, it would amplify, obviously, the effectiveness of what a Pence administration could do.
And
no
even
doubt.
The president has been chiding Pence for his gay stance on gays.
Right. So I mean, I agree with you. The whole question about his perception of women as temptresses, it's sort of this fundamentalist view of... you know, he doesn't want to be in a space, not even a professional space, unless his wife is there or some other people are around to make sure he doesn't. I don't know what I mean. It sort
I don't
of
know
reminds
what he thinks
me.
He's gonna do,
yeah,
but...
exactly. It's a very strange sort of, to me at least, a very strange sort of circumstance where I think of myself as being a professional woman, and if I was working for somebody who didn't want to be around me for a professional business meeting or a consultation because of my gender, I'm kind of thinking, well, this isn't really a
He's
very,
got a problem.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't know what he thinks I would do to, you know, frighten him or make him feel uncomfortable. Or
right,
I mean,
right.
this is so medieval to me. I can't even express how
well,
I interpret that.
Isn't it the same thing who feel strange around homosexuals believing that they're going to hit on them?
Yeah, well, I mean,
good luck with that.
From?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just, it's understanding, right?
Yes, not understanding or sort of having sort of a very enclosed frame of seeing the world around you and...
Well, and also a robust Christian ideology.
Well, it's not just Christian. Let me just say, there are fundamentalist religious beliefs in many, many religions have those kinds of perceptions of woman as temptress. And honestly, I don't like it.
There we go. No reason you should, I don't think. All right, go on, Alan.
Nancy says, the administration wants to raise an underclass. Prisoners are the new slaves. They are an economic asset for private prisons, which need to make a quota in order to be profitable. And that is Nancy. There's no question that there is such a thing as a prison industry in this country. You try to close a prison in upstate New York and you see what the reaction is, because people say it is our major industry here. You know, you have schools, colleges, and you have prisons, and you have hospitals. And they, in most small towns, are the major industry.
You look at the southern tier of New York State, you look around Elmira, you have all these different prisons and jails and things like that, and that is what's driving the economy. It's stabilizing.
To say nothing of the fact that you take somebody out of New York City, which is where most prisoners come from, and you put them next to the Canadian border, you can imagine how difficult it is for a family or anybody else to come and visit with them. So you see that there.
So it's not exactly a rehabilitation process.
There is the understatement of all time.
No. The greatest misnomer ever is a correctional facility. There is nothing correctional about that.
No, it's a holding cell.
Right.
Michael says, Trump and fallen soldiers. Quote from Axios this morning. Relatives of nine of the 43 military members who have died during Trump's presidency, 21% tell AP that they haven't heard from him.
Anyone surprised?
No.
No.
No? I mean, those are tough phone calls.
You bet.
Yeah. And not televised and not tweeted out.
Yeah, right. Exactly. You or have to have.
Well, it shouldn't be, but he would probably prefer that.
Well, yes. But his big problem was that all he had to do was shut up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
All he had to do was inject this into the political discourse, and he would have been all right. But instead, he challenged it, and now it's coming back and biting him where? In the foot? No, the head? No.
Lower? Lower?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the point is all those families deserve to be recognized and receive a letter, a phone call, some communication. But perhaps President Trump should designate somebody else to do that because they might be able to do a little a more effective job at that.
But also back to, and I don't want to belabor this point, but back to there's something that if this were my loved one, my wife, my child, I would want to know what happened.
Absolutely.
And that seems to be what is ultimately missing from this entire, in this case, in...
Yeah, in Niger. Oh,
Niger.
I wanted you to help.
That we would, you know, know what happened.
Yeah, yes. Except what's interesting about what you're saying, both of you, is that while that may be much more important than anything else we're talking about here, it has not risen to the top of the pond in terms of public discourse. What still is, what words did the president use in allegedly consoling the people, parents of the people who died?
That's what he has been focusing on and defending it and saying this is what I said. Well, she's wrong, meaning the mother. Yeah. And,
right, because he has to be right every single time.
Yeah. Nevertheless, we sitting here in this room and most of the people listening know that what was going on in that country is what is so important.
That's right. And that
is not prominent in our political discourse right now.
And if we see four dead special forces coming out of Niger, we will see more from that part of the world.
This
is the beginning of it. And the more information we have available, the more easily we can judge what is happening and perhaps raise new questions or critique what is going on with our counterterrorism policy.
To put a cross the T and dot the I, think Vietnam, think Cambodia. How did it start?
And all I can say is, to the listeners, is not only Niger, watch out what our policy is in Syria now that Raqqa has fallen.
Right.
Will we assign more troops to fight the Assad regime? What will be our encounter with the Russians there? This is a whole new world again. What is the U.S. policy towards the Kurdish militias that have been fighting ISIS? This is a very important moment. We must pay attention if we want to know what the future holds.
All right.
Next one.
The Trump promise of money from Chuck. The liar-in-chief promised to send $1 million of his dollars to Texas for Harvey relief. Did he ever do it? Why all the shock at his daily outrages? This is America Today. No outrage too far. Chuck from Southfield. And John says, condolences. Words matter. The way we structure language matters. For example, quote, he knew what he signed up for could have been your son put his country before himself, and he paid the ultimate price for his patriotism. The American people owe you and your family the deepest debt of gratitude and the highest respect. We grieve with you. Are there no speechwriters in the White House who could put a 3x5 card in front of the president, Trump, when he makes these condolence calls? He shouldn't need a teleprompter to express empathy, but he is obviously incapable of doing so on his own. A brief rehearsal might have avoided the problem, and that's from John. And Deanne says, good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Morning. Good morning.
Meanwhile, while we were talking about the shiny object, the Senate is moving ahead with the tax reform bill that will be devastating. Thank you. And that's from Deanne. All right. Good point.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's why when people think that Trump doesn't know what he's doing, I always have a bit of a reserve in the back of my mind that he does. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. And you look at, you know, obviously there's public Trump and private Trump, and you see a whole different way that he communicates and he operates. And I think we're still seeing that right now.
Sharon says, good morning, panel. Why are we constantly surprised and repulsed by the immature behavior of a narcissistic bully who is pathologically incapable of empathy? From day one, news involving our Doofy, D-O-O-F-Y, Doofy, president, sounds like the antics of a dysfunctional elementary school classroom. While there is a bully in the classroom, those in positions of authority, teachers, principals, parents, get involved and deal with the offending, parenthesis, and this case, offensive individual. When will we, American people, senators, congressmen, and women, White House staff, stand up in a truly substantial way to deal with this embarrassment, bully, or president? Sharon in Haydenville.
I'm shocked over and over again because I don't really understand how our elected representatives do not challenge President Trump more directly, especially from within the Republican Party. There are several that have stepped forward now, but honestly, are people that concerned about their careers? And more concerned about their careers than they are about the future of this country? Now, that is truly disturbing. And so I'm appalled over and over again.
I'd like to answer your question. Yes, they are. They're more concerned about their careers than anything else. They like being United States Senator. They realize if Bannon or the president put somebody up against them in a primary that they could well lose their position, and they don't want to risk doing that. It's that simple. There is no, as I've said many times here, John F. Kennedy type, you know, profile in courage. There just isn't. They just want to hold on to power.
Right. And that is a, sorry, no. Joe, this is a huge problem. I mean, you have to be ethical. You have to be a leader when you're elected for these positions.
Right. So going back to a comment before, it's these 24-hour news cycle profiles of coverage where a senator or a member of the House will say something that will go against the president, but after a cycle, it's over. It's the immediate outreach. You look at what happened with Jeff Flake, and Jeff Flake had made mention about, you know, his reservation about the president, and then where he's no longer talking about that right now.
But it is interesting that when they resign and say they're not going to run again, not resign, but not going to run again, that's when the courage, that's when you see the courage.
Right. Yes.
So it tells you something. Steve says, President Trump's phone call to the widow. Would someone on the panel please comment on how a congressperson happened to be present when President Trump phoned the widow of the serviceman killed in Niger? It is obvious that some preparation has to go into scheduling calls like that, but how much of a media event is it when the president calls a citizen? Well, I think what happened in that case is that she was riding along in a car, and if any of you know now, with the new, when you're talking to the steering wheel, you know, you're talking to the steering wheel, and then everybody else in the car hears what's happening. I think that's what happened. Mm-hmm. The congresswoman was in the car, and they didn't think about the implication of that.
Well, and also, I think it's pretty common for once you have in your state a service member who has died, you know, anybody in a political leadership position reach out to the family and comfort the family. This is very common. So the error was definitely on the White House side not to figure out when to reach the wife of the deceased soldier and sort of figure out what is the most appropriate moment. So, you know, I think there was some miscommunication there or not a very thoughtful approach. So this is fairly common to have other politicians in the room shortly after.
Whether it's on speakerphone
like
or
something.
Well,
weren't they on the way somewhere? Or weren't they on the way either to the funeral or to
the wake, right?
Yeah. And that's why
which is also a very, I mean, this is a particularly sensitive moment. So to think about maybe reaching out at, you know, you have to really have experts to tell the president when to make the phone call.
You want to do it right.
Timing it appropriately. Yeah.
Well, you think about this for a second. Here was this wake coming up. He was being severely criticized by that time. He wanted to get in under the wire, right, and make, you know, and say, I did it, so that nobody could say you didn't do it. Yeah. And that's why the impetus for making that phone call at that time happened.
Yeah, and then maybe he felt rushed, and maybe he was so focused on his agenda rather than on the person's name.
Right. But it calls, I'm not giving him the benefit of the doubt, but it also could have been maybe the only time he could have called.
Perhaps.
Right.
It could have been. Not saying it would have been.
Yep. All right. We're out of time.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. Oh, no, but we'll be back tomorrow, and we're going to... and we have more show coming up. Alan Chartok, Vera Karius-Kelly, Joe Bonilla, thank you all very much for being with us. A great pleasure. We'll be back after this.